Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're well into the month of August, the noted dog days of summer, but it's an important time in the world of community health centers.
This is the 30th celebration of National Health Center Week. This year's theme is celebrating America's health centers, innovators in community health. I think we'd agree innovation is one of the essential hallmarks of our mission as well.
And the National Association of Community Health Centers, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and so many other organizations have given us the kind of support required to improve our care models. The research being conducted at our Weizmann Institute has not only informed the work we do, it's helped us to develop best practices that we can share with our colleagues around the country and around the globe as well.
And speaking of community health centers in other countries, Canada now has a growing community health center movement, which our guests today is very familiar with. Scott Wolf is the director of the Canadian Association of Community Health Centers, which is also focused on ensuring the needs of that nation's underserved population and ensuring everyone has access to great primary care.
It will be interesting to hear about the similarities as well as the differences that drive the Canadian health system and what we can learn from each other.
And Lori Robertson will be checking in, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's looking at misstatements made about health policy in the public domain. You can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. And we'll go to our interview with Scott Wolf in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Centers for Disease Control has expanded the warning area to be avoided by pregnant women because of the Zika virus outbreak, first limited to a small section of Miami-Dade County in Florida. More than a dozen Zika cases have been reported in that region as a direct result from mosquito bites. The greatest threat is to pregnant women's unborn fetuses that can suffer severe birth defects if exposed. Florida Governor Rick Scott has weighed in, urging Congress and the president to take action immediately. The president had asked for $1.9 billion in funds for research and emergency funding for eradication. Congress left for a seven-week recess before acting on that request. Meanwhile, Virginia Senator and Vice Presidential candidate Tim Kaine is joining a growing chorus of lawmakers urging Congress to return from recess for a special session to address the Zika crisis. In addition to the public health threat, Florida's $82 billion tourism industry is already being impacted with cancellations. Meanwhile, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is already testing a potential Zika vaccine, which a number of companies are also working on. This particular clinical trial centers on a so-called DNA vaccine being given to about 80 volunteers. Phase one will test its safety, which dose strength might work best, as well as what kind of immune response can be provoked. Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the NIAID, warns if Congress doesn't act quickly on funding, they may not be able to make it to phase two of the clinical trial. Even if vaccine proves effective in clinical trials, it could be years before a vaccine makes it to the marketplace. There may be a solution to the growing number of American children suffering from asthma, currently more than 10% of the overall school-aged population. And the answer just might be found in an Amish barnyard. Researchers have been working on the so-called hygiene hypothesis for some time, the notion that too many children are being born and raised in environments that are too sterile, denying them the chance to develop a healthy immune response. Scientists studied school-aged Amish children who have extremely low asthma rates, live without electricity, and live adjacent to barns where they play alongside cows and horses frequently, compared to Hutterite children, similar lifestyle, but farm animals are housed in industrial barns far from the living space. The Hutterite children had a far higher rate of asthma. Researchers are zeroing in on what compounds in Amish farmyard dust are triggering the growth of neutrophils in the blood, which stimulates an immune response to allergens, often a trigger for asthma. Researchers found the Amish dust was loaded with debris from bacteria, while the Hutterite dust was not. And when they applied the compounds to lab mice, the same response occurred in the mice exposed to Amish dust. No asthmatic response. Asthma experts see this discovery as a potential breakthrough for staving off the development of asthma in the first place. And to floss or not to floss, that may no longer be a question. A study out of the National Institutes of Health, the Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research, found little evidence that regular flossing has any real protective effect against cavities and gum disease. Other studies had shown a modest impact on the development of gingivitis from both brushing and flossing together versus brushing alone, but that the effect was negligible. Recent Department of Health and Human Services guidelines are focusing more on the destructive impact of sugars on the teeth rather than flossing's effect to reverse that. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Scott Wolf, Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Community Health Centers. Mr. Wolf also serves as Acting Coordinator of the International Federation of Community Health Centers. He served as Director of Global Health Policy for the International Association of Providers in AIDS Care, as well as Communications Advisor in programs on non-communicable diseases and health resources at the Pan-American Health Organization. Mr. Wolf serves as a Senior Policy Advisor for the Association of Ontario Health Centers. He earned his Master's in Political Science from the University of Toronto. Scott, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's my pleasure to join you.
Yeah, you know, you really keep a keen eye on what's happening both here in the United States and obviously in Canada. But I think Americans may not have as good of a lens on what's been happening with Canada's health systems, which it has universal access to care for all citizens, though I've heard you talk and between the lip and the cup, there are always things that may not be fully illuminated. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand how the Canadian health system has evolved over time and what are some of its key features today?
I'd start by saying that we see our Canadian healthcare system as an evolving entity beginning in the early 1960s. The first attempt at a universalized, a single-payer system in Canada was achieved in the province of Saskatchewan in the early 1960s, immediately followed by a doctor's strike. There was resistance to the implementation of a single-payer system. From that point, 1962 through to 1984, when at the federal level, a Canadian government implemented the Canada Health Act, which outlines the core principles and requirements of the universalized public health care system across all of the provinces and territories in Canada. But as of 1984, we did have a universalized public health care system across all provinces and territories that covered a basic number of services. And so we say that, in fact, 70% of total spending on health care in Canada is achieved through our public health care system, what we refer to generally as Medicare here, so not to confuse that with Medicare in the United States. Mm-hmm. What's covered within that is a compromise. What's covered is basic physician and hospital services, as well as a variety of other services. What's not included within our universalized system, eye care, dental care, physiotherapy is a common one. And so there's a major gap in access to all of those. There are essentially two stages to Medicare. The first stage of Medicare is to bring everyone and everything within coverage, a single-payer system. And I would say we still haven't completed that first stage. We're still working towards pharmacare and publicly funded dental care, for example. Those are two priority issues for many groups across the country. The second stage, and I know we might touch on this a little bit further, is really to focus not exclusively on ensuring coverage, but what the best models for service delivery are, mm-hmm. so that we can do a better job at actually preventing need for healthcare services.
Well, Scott, I would say sort of the on the ground, you know, what you hear in the United States is Canada universal access to primary care, almost no out-of-pocket costs for things like prenatal and childbirth or basic surgeries. But the common refrain we also hear, long delays for some services, and then the growing out-of-pocket expense. How's that trend impacting overall care delivery in Canada? And are you seeing the kinds of delays or avoidance of even necessary care because people feel so constrained by those out-of-pocket expenses?
There are many individuals who, despite having access to a single-payer system here, don't have access to a routine primary healthcare provider. So there are definitely challenges. Governments in Canada are not required to actually move beyond, you know, those limited services. That's not to say that many don't move beyond that limitation. Many of the challenges we face are owing to inappropriate delivery of services. Access to physician services alone is an inadequate primary care response. What people need is access to team-based care, where not only are we tending to immediate medical and biological concerns, but also people's lived realities, the determinants of health, because as we know, 80% or more of what affects and impacts health lies outside of the healthcare system. Proper. And so what we're faced with is a problem of orientation and form of healthcare services. We're not alone in advocating reforms to the way that services are delivered throughout the country. Others, where we can do a better job. To touch on the way that this relates to the privatization of services, yes, there is an increasing trend towards privatizing some services, the introduction of user fees by some provinces, the emergence of boutique healthcare services, the demand for some privatized services such as MRIs, paid for plasma, et cetera. There's a legitimate demand for these services because there are challenges within our public service. We're not facing unavoidable and insurmountable challenges owing to an aging population. It's just that we've got to do a better job at delivering services in the right places at the right times and through the right models. And so when segments of our population demand access to private services and say, well, you know, I, as a relatively well-to-do individual or family can afford to pay for a private MRI, why don't you allow me to do that? Mm-hmm. Because it would then naturally take my demand out of the public system and create increased space within the public system. That's actually an incorrect assertion. The ability to access services out of pocket does not mean that you have increased the supply of healthcare providers, does not mean that you've added new health infrastructure, et cetera. What in fact you're doing is you're exacerbating the pressures on the public system.
Scott, speaking of the public health system, I thought we focused little on community health centers. And I think many of our listeners know that they've been providing quality primary care to underserved and uninsured populations in the U.S., real focus in on economically vulnerable immigrant populations, but really also they're a voice and vehicle for social change in terms of how they're organized. The majority of the board of directors are the patients themselves, as you mentioned earlier, a real focus in on team-based care, always focused in on primary care. Could you illuminate for our listeners what's happening with the community health centers in Canada, the role that they play in serving the underserved population across the provinces in the country?
Unfortunately, we in Canada don't benefit from the same federal angle that you do in the United mm-hmm. States. Community health centers in the United States benefit from federal legislation and funding, which enables not only a degree of public awareness about community health centers, but a degree of similarity in mission, approach, and so forth across the country. Now, here in Canada, health care, as it's understood, is primarily a responsibility of the provinces. It means that the provinces are left to their own devices to determine how to ensure access to primary care services. And so there are varying levels of progress across the provinces in terms of moving from a medicalized model to a team-based care approach and integrating into that attention to determinants of health. There is no similar model through which community health centers are funded from province to province. The way that community health centers have come into being varies quite significantly. What I think it says is that there's something virtuous and organic about mm-hmm. the community mm-hmm. health center that, regardless of how the soil is fertilized. The desire to make access available to services that meet people where they're at and that understand that in order to improve health outcomes, we've got to provide more than just healthcare services. But they don't have a framework into which to fit. So it's quite a disparate movement throughout the country, but we've achieved a great degree of success. And I would say the future is incredibly bright. And I think public awareness is increasing around what community health centers are, why they're so vital, and why they're necessary.
Well, I think you've captured the evolution and done it in a very speeded up time frame. And I would imagine that you are finding yourself at one of the pressure points that community health centers and the whole healthcare system in the U.S., and I'm betting in Canada, are facing as well, and that's the training of the clinical workforce that's prepared to work in a team-based model of primary care. That's a big focus area for primary care in the U.S. and for community health centers in the U.S. right now. And we would be curious about what the workforce development strategies are that are evolving in the Canadian health system.
It's a little bit of a different story here in that, in principle, our universal healthcare system provides for universal access to primary care. And so it has already been previewed and built into the system that we need to train and fund a healthcare workforce that attends to the needs of the entire population. I think the major challenges here in Canada are the shift from the medicalized model to a mixture of complementary models, which would include team-based clinical services that might be, you know, serving some of the population, and then more robust services like community health centers that are required to meet the needs of a different segment of the population. So I think it's really around the shift in how primary care services are delivered as opposed to training up the number of providers. There's a lack of policy in many provinces to actually enable allied health staff to work within the primary care setting. You know, nurse practitioners are licensed in all of the provinces. However, the majority of the limited supply of nurse practitioners tend to filter into acute care settings because there just aren't the funding mechanisms for them to practice in primary care. So it really relates to diversification of the primary care workforce, fitting that workforce into the appropriate models, and then all of the policies that are necessary to enable that workforce to practice in the ways and places that are needed. The other area I would say that is discussed far too infrequently is the need to actually shift training programs. Providers from different disciplines do a lot more in-training collaboration with practitioners from other disciplines.
We're speaking today with Scott Wolf, Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Community Health Centers. Mr. Wolf also serves as Acting Coordinator of the International Federation of Community Health Centers. Scott, you know, I'd really like to learn more about the work that's going on there. And as Margaret said earlier, everybody is sort of at a point in time, but they all have teachable moments for each other about the work they're doing in providing primary care for the underserved. And tell us, what are the goals and aspirations of the larger global movement?
We established the International Federation of Community Health Centers in 2012, and so we're still quite young as a federation. I would list among our key achievements over the past few years as two or three formalized global exchanges among community health centers. So really building the knowledge exchange and learning program for the International Federation. We've had the opportunity for community health center representatives from Australia, throughout Europe, the United States, and Canada at different points to participate in global exchanges with each other. I think in addition to that, it's really developing a mechanism for ongoing information exchange and enabling each other to access examples of success in other jurisdictions to better address the particular challenges that we might be facing in our own jurisdictions. And so to be able to relate back to our respective funders, policymakers, and other partners, that there is a rich community health center movement in another jurisdiction. We, for instance, are tremendously thankful for the rich supply of evidence that you have in the United States regarding the community health center model, why governance is important, the impact of health services on local economic development, reduction in avoidable hospitalizations, and so forth. But our realities are similar enough that we can extrapolate from your experiences and your evidence to make the case here. And likewise, I know that others are looking at what we do have in Canada to be able to further support their own local efforts in their countries. And we've just only begun. I think there's a tremendous trajectory for the International Federation of Community Health Centers and for our global movement. And I hope you'll have myself or other colleagues back on the program in another number of years to talk further about the successes we've achieved by then.
I'm sure we will, but I'm going to also ask you to just comment, if you would, on an area we haven't talked so much about, and that's, you know, beyond all of us on the team and organizing and delivering services. We've certainly learned a lot from looking around the world as well as in the United States on the capacity of low-cost interventions such as mobile apps for community health workers armed with a smartphone being deployed in regions with little in the way of a healthcare infrastructure. And that's especially true maybe in rural areas, but I'm not sure it's any less true in urban areas. Any thoughts about what you've learned from your global partners and from the work that's going around the country that you think is a high value or high priority for implementation in your system?
I like to say that I knew community health centers before I knew community health centers. As you noted at the outset of the program, I came to the community health center movement in Canada after work internationally and largely focused on HIV prevention, care, and support. And throughout my travels in the Caribbean, throughout Latin America, and Eastern and Southern Africa, for instance, what struck me is that wherever there was a successful program that not only was reducing incidence of HIV, but was successfully introducing antiretroviral therapy, and bear in mind, we're talking 15 or 20 years ago at the outset of scale-up of ART in resource-poor settings, there was something special about those places where it was working well. And it was working well because there was an integration of a clinical component with all of the other wraparound components that we know through community health centers are essential to improving outcomes. And so a local community garden to ensure that people had access to the nutritious foods that they require, especially in the context of antiretroviral therapy. Local micro enterprises to ensure that we're not only providing the care and support for people, but helping them to rise out of poverty and so forth. None of these examples, as I can recall, were articulated as community health centers, but they were in essence community health centers. Mm-hmm. And many of them, much of this work was being done at low or no cost. And so I think that while we want to keep our eyes on the need for funding through our respective healthcare systems in those more affluent countries such as ours, we really do need to take inspiration from locations around the world where innovative provider groups that are being trained to achieve specific goals, such as community health workers, local cultural peer educators, and others have been introduced to the health system and are adding tremendous benefits to it. Again, there are many things that can be accomplished at low or no cost. And I think in witnessing how this is done in resource-limited contexts, it inspires us to think of how we might achieve something similar in our own settings. No tangible examples come immediately to mind, but I think the key to it is maintaining an open mind, understanding that there's a virtue to the approach, and it is really providing clinical services, but wrapping around that the supports and health equity and social justice approach to individual, family, and community development that enables us to, you know, understand that we do have a lot to learn from resource-limited settings.
We've been speaking today with Scott A. Wolfe, Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Community Health Centers and the International Federation of Community Health Centers. You can learn more about their work by going to cachc.ca, or you can follow him on Twitter at Scott A. Wolfe. That's Wolfe with an E. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump has said that enhanced interrogation works, but scientists have shown that the stress and pain induced by techniques like waterboarding can impair memory and therefore inhibit a person from recalling information. Trump has made the claim a few times. In a report released in 2014, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence said that the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation wasn't effective in acquiring intelligence. But we took a look at what scientific research on that topic has shown. Enhanced interrogation can entail techniques such as sleep deprivation, cramped confinement, and waterboarding, which triggers the feeling of drowning. A 2009 review paper in Trends in Cognitive Science found that the idea that suspects would be motivated to end enhanced interrogation by revealing truthful information from their long-term memories isn't supported by the scientific evidence. And in fact, that evidence suggests that the opposite can occur. Suspects may give incorrect information. Research has looked at how increased stress affects brain regions and the mechanisms involved in memory function. Prolonged and extreme stress has a negative effect on brain regions needed for short and long-term memory function. It may be difficult to determine whether a suspect is being truthful because information presented by the captor can accidentally become part of the suspect's memory, and a suspect could also produce false memories. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. On any given day, about 4 million Americans can be found utilizing their local library. While the percentage is uncertain, a good many of these patients are homeless, often with nowhere else to go for a warm, dry place, access to internet, and clean bathrooms. An estimated 15% of the daily patrons at the San Francisco Main Library hail from the city's homeless population of about 7,000 people. Often this population not only lacks access to safe housing, but to much-needed social services as well. So they decided to capitalize on the opportunity to help their homeless patrons by hiring the nation's first library-based psychiatrist social worker.
I always say that it's easier to do outreach on the streets because it's a neutral territory. But here, it's their safe place. It's their sanctuary. So I try to be very respectful. My way is, hi, I don't know if you know that there's a social worker at the library. I just say, you know, we have these services. If you think you might want to know more about it, I'm available. I'm always here.
Social worker Leah Escara speaks to a reporter from PBS recently. She understands the challenges of leading the homeless population to behavioral health interventions and social services that will best meet their need.
I do the full clinical assessment, and then I make a presentation to my colleagues at the San Francisco Homeless Outreach Team. They provide case management and also housing.
Since they launched the program at the San Francisco Library, hundreds of homeless patrons have benefited from behavioral health and addiction services, and many have also found themselves with ultimate solutions to their homelessness, permanent homes. Some 24 libraries across the country have initiated similar programs following San Francisco's novel model.
I become a familiar face at the library, so people know me. And actually, it's interesting, even on the streets, they go, you're the library lady or you're the social worker.
A responsive, strategically situated behavioral health clinician being made available to those most in need, using the opportunity to lead the population to the care and shelter they most need. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.